Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Oh, hello. Welcome to Waypoints. It's Wednesday, and the Waypoint staff and friends are taking a little break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring us. And let's try to think of a nicer way to say pissed us off lately. Let's say provoking.
Consternated
things that have been provoking us lately.
Yes.
Love it.
Gathered around the table this Wednesday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Danielle Randeau.
Hi.
And Austin Walker.
That's me. Hey.
So I would say right now to lead us off, it's fair to characterize the current moment as like a golden age of true crime. If you look at the podcasting and documentary spaces right now, you'll find a lot of really popular real-life whodunits, re-examinations of controversial cases. So with that in mind, Austin, why don't you tell us about the mystery that Serial's third season is serving up?
The mystery is, why is the criminal justice system, how many ways is the criminal justice system broken in a way that primarily harms marginalized folk?
Oh, so it's like institutional murder on the Orient Express, where they all done it.
everyone is complicit. You and me too, Rob. That is the, so I guess I'll set it up a little bit for people who haven't followed Serial over the last few years, which, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I actually don't know how deep it's penetrated into our community necessarily for a couple of reasons. One, it was this big crossover success with a lot of what I think people on Twitter, in our Twitter circles, would call normies. It was like a big pivot point for people who came on board to podcasting for the first time, who had never listened to podcasts before. So I know that a huge part of its listenership is people who only just recently came to podcasts. And I know a lot of our fans have listened to podcasts for quite some time. But also, there was a lot of pushback on the first season in spite of its success. So the first season followed a murder case from Baltimore, from Maryland, in which an Asian American woman was killed by an Arab American, or was supposedly killed, allegedly killed. Well, yeah, was allegedly killed by an Arab American man. And the episode to episode, the case, the team at Serial, which is a bunch of producers previously at This American Life, like Sarah Koenig, Koenig, dug into the case and introduced you to the characters, the suspects, the people who were witnesses or adjacent to witnesses, to the complications, to the poor reporting and to the poor defense that was given to the primary suspect. And week by week, everyone kind of followed along with the same tenacity and curiosity that you would a prestige TV drama or a detective novel. And somewhere along the line, I think a lot of folks did come to the realization like, oh, wait, no, these are real people. This is not characters in a piece of fiction I love. And also, it is specifically marginalized folks. Like it is part of what makes that story so filled with complexity is the fact that this is an Asian American woman, an Asian American girl who was killed. And that the primary suspect and the alleged killer was an Arab American man, and the all of the stereotypes and all of the prejudices that go into what a case like that looks like in the American mind. But it ended up feeling at times kind of exploitative, and more than that, and I think this is the part that Serial, that the producers over at Serial have tried to address both in this current season and also in their season two. They realized, like, oh, actually, this doesn't say much about anything. And they kind of kick off this new season, which is about a year spent in a single courthouse in Cleveland, Ohio. Nope, is that wrong? That's right.
I think
no,
it's right.
Or maybe it's outside Cleveland, the lake, but it's in
it is.
The
it,
first
is it is. It is. My brain got confused because of a different thing we're going to talk about later. I was like, wait, am I confusing this?
Welcome to the Ohio themed episode of Waypoints.
It really All is. Right. It's super weird. So yeah, for a year in a single courthouse in Cleveland. As a way of saying, like, okay, this is, we don't want to look at the exceptional case. We don't want to look at the case where there were so many complications that it's hard to have something, have a takeaway about the criminal justice system. Instead, we should look at a bunch of average, ordinary cases that happen in here day by day, week by week. And what can that tell us about the criminal justice system? I think to some degree that's a return to form for them, because the second season, which was about an army deserter,
Bo Bergdahl.
Bo Bergdahl. Was poorly received is what I would say. I think a lot of people found it boring. It didn't have
like part of the criticism of the first season that you're alluding to is about like the sexiness of like true crime dramas, and that leads into the feelings of exploitation if they're not handled correctly, which is partly tied up in the stylistic way that Serial is done, which is like a very conversational casual style where you feel on the same level as Sarah Koenig and the producers, where it's like, oh, we're all just like, what's this is weird. Like, there's a certain style to it that is part of what makes it appealing and approachable. Yeah. And in
which
the second
is something
season,
about the intimacy that she, you know, that she developed with various subjects in that season. Like, there's definitely,
she sounds like a normal person. Yes. She doesn't sound like a figure of authority. She's just someone that like you're meeting at the bar with someone and they're laying out some paperwork and they're like, I'm going to explain to you why this is fucked up and we're going to walk through it. In the second season, like, part of what I liked about the second season, I think it's underrated.
Me too.
Yes, it's more boring, but it's boring because it's like, it lives in a gray area where there are not real answers. It just like is, go read up on Bo Bergdahl's, you know, situation and you'll see how quickly it gets complicated. We don't have time to get into it here. But I liked that part of the second season where you just lived in a mixture of I don't knows. And then the third season, I think, takes some of that approach, but like realizes that like there's power in like getting concrete lessons or things you can build on in a way like this. The new season has a structure to it, like that is starting very small and beginning to, it's only two episodes
it's
in,
two
but
episodes
you start
in.
To see where, like, the direction they're going to start going.
It also, I think, it avoids another major problem with that first season, and even with the second one to some degree, which is you get to the end of that first season of Serial, and there's no takeaway. It's like, well, did Adnan Syed do this or not? And like, well, we were making the show as it was coming out, and like, there wasn't a big break. They didn't crack the case, right? There was not in a way that actually kind of, I think, hammered home some of this. What you were left with was a bunch of bad feelings, right? You were left with just like,
a lot of people. It feels like a lot of people got screwed.
A lot of people,
and it's and you're not sure who, and you're not. And it's fine for things to end messy,
yes.
But it didn't felt like it ended messy with a point. Like, it wasn't like the messiness was the point.
No.
It just ended messy because they had to, like, get out and move on to a new story because there was nowhere else to go with this particular one. You should set up, like, the first story. Cause they pick a very specific story
on this
for the first episode.
For this season, you're saying? Or
for this season, yeah.
Yes. So, this season, comparatively, because each episode is a story, is about one thing that happens inside of this courthouse, they're able to have like an entire, they're able to have a resolution. So the first episode of this season is about a bar fight. And you know, the way
my
that they
favorite.
Said, of course, you've been in a couple recently, my understanding. You broke it up
I
a couple.
I pull people off of other people in bar fights. That's more of what I do.
Or did you commit felony assault?
Right.
Oh, no.
That's the question, right? So there's a young woman who goes into a bar. The way
specifically white.
Specifically like, a young white
like
woman.
And they make the point that, like, there's like a line from the first episode that's like, where they talk. Anyway, like they
being,
chose someone
the,
who's
the line. I mean, you mean the line about how whiteness doesn't ever hurt?
Yeah, it doesn't ever hurt.
It's like, listen,
it never helps to be black. It never hurts to be white.
Exactly.
It never hurts to be.
Yeah, exactly. So, she walks into this bar. She goes to this bar with her friend. It's not a bar she normally goes to. It's kind of described the way you can hear some people describe, like, oh yeah, it's like it's a bar. It's, I don't want to say it's like a white trash bar, but it's presented as a sort of like low income, like working class,
well white, drinks,
you know, 40, 50 year olds who've been around the block, who've been here for 20 years.
They're wearing flannel.
They're wearing flannel and jeans, you know, and denim. That is, and the white woman is sort of presented as like, I don't normally go to bars like this, blah, 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 whatever. Gets into I completely reduced it. She goes there, and camera footage shows that a man continues to harass her, to touch her, and she is like, get the fuck away from me. Another woman confronts her, and they get into a fight. It's not 100% clear who threw the first blow or whatever, but it breaks out into a not just a fight, but what is described as like a pile-on of her.
It's a beatdown.
It's a beatdown. A whole bar.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm not even sure you can call it as a brawl. Like, it's an upsetting story because, like, and this is the what's sort of compelling about this first case. It's easy to imagine yourself being in this woman's position. You're at a bar that, like, that bar has locals. You are not one of them. You are not one of the regulars. But also the way it escalates, like, it's not just a guy, like, grabs her ass. It is that a guy repeatedly slaps it. She turns around and confronts the guy.
Multiple times.
And that seems to intensify it. Like, because she's saying, like, what the fuck, man? He just starts, like, going ham. Just, like, slapping repeatedly now. Like, what are you going to do about it? And that's when these other, like, regulars, these other women show up and get in this woman's face. And then it turns into a beatdown of this woman who originally, like, the only thing she did was try to get a drink. Right. And to stop object to having her ass grabbed.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
It wasn't a brawl. It wasn't like people, like, you know, it wasn't Donnybrook.
100%. Exactly. It wasn't like her and her crew versus some other crew. Right, she was just getting beat. And she fights her way up. A cop shows up. There had been a cop nearby? Is that what the situation?
He was going to the bathroom. He was, he'd come down the block.
Okay. And he's like, oh shit, there's this fight. Gets into the middle of it. And in the process, she's throwing fists. She's back up on her feet and hits him. It is not ever made clear in the episode if that's a swing at him or if that's a swing in general. I know where my suspicion lies. Mm-hmm. But he puts her in the back of the car and says, listen, I have to arrest you. I have to bring you. I have to put you in this car. I have to put you in cuffs. You assaulted a police officer. At that point, things get really messy because he...
And he specifically says, yes. I have no intention to charge you. Yes. I'm not, like, and tells the other people in the bar, like, this is just a protocol. She's just got to, this is the thing that happens when a police officer gets hit. I don't want this to escalate.
Well, like, which is wild, because the bar patrons at this point are like, don't arrest her. What are you doing? Don't arrest her. Like, motherfucker, you were hitting her. You were kicking her on the ground a second ago, lady. Like, what are you talking about? But then the real drama of it ends up unfolding at the courthouse, because, of course, she does get charged. And immediately you start to see the gears of the justice system fail to mesh, right? The teeth of the gears not quite lining up, because information changes via communication, and suddenly it looks like a really good case that they could pursue. And of course, if you're in court in 2018, the system expects you to plea out and to take whatever, you know, kind offer they give you. And she's wound up with a defense attorney that is confident that he can actually win this case, which is not a thing that happens ever. Like, the numbers that come up in this show in terms of, like, how many cases get pleaded out. Also, for years I'd said pled out, but then listening to this show, it's always pleaded, and I looked online, it's pleaded, and I don't know where the fuck I started saying
it is pleaded.
It is pleaded. I don't know where what I was doing. Anyway, it's like 98% get their plea deals to go to trial, and those 2% aren't all fucking not guilty.
And the plea deals are like misdemeanors, which is right. And as the show, like, does a good job explaining, like, where everyone looks at that as a win. Like, this person, like, cool, like, they say the system worked,
right?
And then Sarah Koenig explains, like, what a misdemeanor means, the cost that is, especially for low-income people.
Yes.
And it's just, like, this is not a win at all for someone who was truly, like, seemed truly innocent.
And that is the rest of that. The rest of that episode is, hey, her defense attorney is just trying to make it happen and trying to get the court to drop the charges or to declare, you know, to basically do more than just reduce it to a misdemeanor. Because at this point it's a felony because she hit this cop and they've decided it's a felony assault. And it's this, like, really weird bureaucratic nightmare of being in meetings with people who you've no rapport with and who have their own supervisors, who have their own goals and stuff like that. And then, the end cost of it all is like, okay, well, this woman had to go to court for every day for 30 days and does not live near the courthouse. And, you know, maybe she doesn't have money to imagine, like, every day for 30 days straight, you have to go to the courthouse to check in for something, right?
Jesus.
Like, that is not nothing. on top of lawyer fees and fees that make no sense. There was some fee in there. There's like a list of, like, you know, the park fee, the judge's fee, the bailiff's fee, like all sorts of stuff that are eventually
it's like going to Ticketmaster.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's 100% like that, except it's also, you know, you were innocent. You know that what happened was you got jumped at the fucking bar. And that first episode is just a really great example of, and this is the thing that is so good, is like, oh, and this is considered success in the system. She got it knocked down from a felony to a misdemeanor. She didn't have to do time, like, besides the 4 days over the, you know, between when she was first booked and then made bond or whatever.
Still spent 4 days in jail,
which is a
shitty
lot.
Jail.
Yeah,
I mean, all jail is shitty, but like this one was like the Cleveland one is described as like a particularly heinous place and gross place to end up.
Right, and so then that's the first episode. Second episode digs into a specific judge and like the ways in which his court are his petty kingdom. Are you know he is. He, you know, completely runs that place and it delivers fucking, you know, lectures on fatherhood to the black guys who pass through the system.
Christ. And uses all sorts of slang and vernacular that he should not be using and that he, in conversation, justifies as, well, this is how I connect with the people that come through my courtroom.
And yet it's like, he does not use it with the black producer of the show. Interesting. Weird.
Huh. Yeah. Oh. Wow. Yeah.
Who speaks with a British accent, by the way, which is a whole other story. Anyway, it is such a step forward, I think, for the show because it's trying to dig at something. I still think there are missteps. You know, I think there are lots of presumptions about who's listening that probably reflect statistically, but would still be better off if they were a little more inclusive. You know, there are moments where Sarah is like, you know, if it was your record or my record, the difference wouldn't matter between a this misdemeanor level and this misdemeanor level or whatever. Or, you know, there's a bit in which she talks about, to be clear, I want to clarify why I think that is like presumptive. It's like, you don't know what my record is. There are people listening to us right now who I know have felony records, right? Like, that is a thing that happens in America. That's the point of this season, is that you can wind up with a record even though you're innocent. Or you can wind up with a record because that's how life is. And sometimes you do stupid shit and you do shit that you regret and crimes happen. That doesn't mean that you're not going to listen to a podcast eventually, right? And so like, I think there is a very much still a very presumed white middle class, you know, listening audience here that kind of seeps its way into the perspective of the show. I also think that comes up, there's a bit in which they start talking about that judge who was the kind of petty tyrant who wants to improve the lives of people. And the show describes him as being an optimist, right? As being like, he thinks his work can help the community. And they say like, the rest of that episode is like, he isn't actually helping the community, or here are the ways in which he's bad. The thing that the show should take is like, it doesn't matter if he's an optimist or not. It shouldn't matter if he wants to help the community or not. And they don't actually make that part of the argument. They continue to paint him throughout that as like a misguided tyrant instead of someone who is just fundamentally harmful and corrupt. And it's easier to do that when, like, I think partially it's about access and about like having that relationship. He's a great interview. He's a fantastic interview. And they do a good job of showing the ways in which he gains control over people's lives, the ways in which the system, by giving people probation instead of actually jail time, he's able to stay in their lives in different ways. But there was just like, there is still that presumptive who is making this and who is this for. Still, I think it's a great first step for this season. I'm excited to see the rest of it. I'm excited for people who have that platform to be using it in this way.
Yeah, the show could be, it leaves too much for you to read into what's happening when I think it should be a little more explicit about what's happening. I think it's gotten better. It's better at that. Like this season is, but because of like what they're treading in, which is like the criminal justice system, like people just know so little about, even someone that like tries to pay attention, tries to read up on it, like there are still so many things about this that are illuminating. So it's like, all right, if someone like me still needs, like, don't let me just read into the text, I need you to explain it and like break this down, like I hope the show like doesn't lose that as it goes forward. But it is a fascinating, really fascinating series so far, and I'm really enjoying it as well.
Danielle, looks like you had some thoughts as we were sort of discussing just the what happens inside a courthouse.
Well, yeah, I used to go to court all the time when I worked at the ACLU. I would record cases and things like that. And my dad's a lawyer, so there are many times in my life I've sort of watched my dad argue a case. Oh, boy. I just have so many thoughts and feelings about the American criminal justice system that probably can't completely fit here. But yeah, it is really, really one aspect of it that my old executive director at the ACLU in Boston used to talk about is just how much it's 85% theater. And absolutely, utterly has nothing to do with the truth of the case or the facts of the case or anything like that. She used to describe particular courthouses in Boston and specific rooms, and know it. You would know who a new lawyer was or an old hand at this with the exact spot they stood in, because they knew exactly, like, basically the staging of it. Like, the acoustics are perfect in this spot to really hammer home your point. So when you were going to, you know, do your closing arguments, you would stand in this spot. And you would dramatically, you know, sort of reach over and gesture towards the jury. It's just really, really, it's so frustrating. It's fascinating in so many ways, but so frustrating how much of court is just theater. And it is just playing to the politics of that particular room, that particular judge, that particular jury, all of it.
Daniel, did you listen through the second episode?
I have actually never listened to any Serial.
Okay, so because of the specific point you're making, there is a, I don't want to spoil it, I guess, like, there's a moment involving a letter involving someone in the system, and, like, the letter is, like, very fawning to this judge, very deferential, very, like, you've been a positive figure in my life, you're helping me, like, you're like, thank you so much for, like, being, you know, tough love sort of thing, like, I've found a new path forward. And it's just a really striking moment, because as you're listening to this part play out, you know, I'm listening to this and going, like, man, this motherfucker's playing some good politics. Like, he is playing to the ego of this judge. And then it cuts to, like, the judge, like, tearing up as he's reading it privately in his chambers. And then some shit happens. It's not great. And at the end, like, they ask the kid, like, why I wrote the letter. It's like, I was just flattering that motherfucker. Like, I thought this was my path out of here. And it was just amazing to watch it work. And it, like, that was actually awesome, like, one of those moments where, like, I wish the show was more explicit about it, explaining, like, what happened there. Because, like, it's implicit that, like, oh, he was just taking this judge for a ride and, like, playing to his ego. But they let the guy off the hook a little too much in terms of, like, explaining out exactly, like, the series of events that occurred there. But it is 100%, like, if you listen to nothing else, Danielle, listen to the second episode and that bit, because it is absolutely what you are describing. It is politics and theater in just to such a frustrating degree that... I think part of what's so great about this season so far is that, like, if this was happening in, like, normal cases that we take for granted, then your head starts scratching at, well, what's happening in these, like, far more complicated cases, which I imagine the series will go into. But it's like, if it can't get basic shit right, like, Lord help the stuff where there's actually a gray area.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think something that this is my first experience listening to Serial as well. I missed the first two seasons. Something I really enjoyed in the first episode, at least, is this idea of, like, the system as a place and a community. It was very much like that first episode in particular is also about that stuff you're talking about, Danielle, where it's like there's a politics beyond just the case in front of you. It's like, how is the bailiff going to feel about you? How are they process? Like, everybody's going to have to face each other tomorrow, and there's going to be favors owed and favors collected, and, like, there's that other game being played. And so, yeah, you advocate for your client. But also, you live here. Client's going to leave. The case is going to end. But, like, all the players going to be here tomorrow doing it again. And I think that's something this series is doing a really effective job of bringing out, and how that changes the way the criminal justice system works and sort of tweaks it away from the ideal, which is, like, the pure adversarial advocacy model.
Right. There's like an architectural model here that they set up really nicely right away, which is like there is literally a vertical hierarchy in this building. It's like, you know, the people who are being booked are coming in through the basement with beat cops. You know, a level above that are clerks. A level above that are detectives. And then, like, floors 3, 4, and 5 are various judges, with 3 being the kind of, like, the misdemeanor courts and you know, personal finances and all that stuff.
Family court.
Exactly. And it is that's really effective. And I think it's in episode 2, she also breaks down, like, all right, well, like, this is primarily a black and white courthouse, and black folks are security guards, and they work reception, And they are clerks, but not ever, you know, lawyers. And they are, you know, judges are primarily white. Bailiffs are primarily white. Detectives are primarily white. Like, it's a super interesting breakdown of the demographics of the courthouse, in which you can see the same power dynamics functioning both architecturally and across the makeup of the actual people who work there day in, day out.
So I think, you know, that, so you can find that really easily on pretty much any podcast platform.
Yes.
So Serial, yes. Very Serial popular, doesn't need our fucking easy promo. To find. Yes. Yeah. yeah. Just very easy to find. But speaking of like bureaucracies and institutions and the people who live and or don't live within them, my waypoint this week is Akira Kurosawa's 1952 film Ikaru, which is a movie I'd put off watching because it sounds depressing as hell. So when I give you the pitch, you're going to be like, boy, that sounds fucking bleak. And it's a little bleak, but not all the way. So Ikaru is about a bureaucrat, the sort of person who inhabits the bowels of these massive government institutions. And the guy's name is Kanji Watanabe. He's played by Takashi Shimura, who does a fantastic job in this role. And in the opening, like, we know from the start something this guy doesn't, which is that he's got, like, terminal stomach cancer.
Yeah.
And by the end of, like, the first 20 minutes, he's going to learn that he has this illness. And he's going to have this crisis of, what the fuck have I done with my life? Like, really, what is the point of this? Like, it's established at the start, he is one of those paper-pushing bureaucrats whose primary function is to put people's hopes, dreams, and aspirations into a circular file and just, like, send it off into the system where nothing's ever going to happen except they get older. And so he comes to this realization of, like, I've got 3 to 6 months left with my life, and I've been dead, basically, for years. That's how he feels. Like, he's just wasted everything. And so the film kind of has this like, bifurcated structure. The first half of the film is him desperately trying to learn, like, what's the secret? Like, how do you live? And he goes on this sort of journey trying to figure out what does it look like to take advantage of life. He starts out by going out with this sort of itinerant poet on Night on the Town, which is a fantastic sequence because it's this really... I had no picture in my head of what, like, post-war Japan looked like. And so it's also just fascinating as an artifact of, like, Japanese nightlife in the wake of World War II. Mm-hmm. And there's all this, like, dynamism. Like, it's a really cool sequence and, you know, really gives you a glimpse at a setting you might not have seen much of. The second half of the film is the dude's wake. Like, he's just, like, boom. Like, 1 minute he's like, I've got it. I'm going to live. Next cut is his wake. His framed picture.
Photo at the front of the shrine at his wake. It's great.
And I got it, like, the shot, that edit, that moment, the moment where he has his realization, I'm going to do something before I'm done. He's at this restaurant where in the background there's been these people having this party this entire time and, like, gifts have been coming to the table.
Fuck.
And as he stands up, this group that's been established from the start of the scene is having this little party over there.
There's, like, a cake that shows up at one point.
Yeah.
There's, like,
right.
You just get these little moments of, like, he's having a very, in the foreground, he's having a really intense conversation, right? And in the background, they're like, oh, the cake is here, and, like, oh, everyone has, like, great dresses. And you're like, okay, I guess there's a party in the background. What the fuck ever? And then, Rob.
He stands up, and it's like, it's almost like the Spike Lee shot. Looking, it's the tracking shot. Like facing up and at his face as he moves to this restaurant and the party in the background strike up Happy Birthday to You. And
it's a surprise party. Someone shows up and is like, this woman showed, I just watched this last night. So it's like super fresh. This woman shows up in her like little black dress and like, is like, oh, and they start singing Happy Birthday to You as this guy who has literally wasted 30 years of his life is dying of stomach cancer and has finally realized that what he wants to do is try to bring joy to someone in the world before he dies, is like, it finally dawns on him. It's just this perfect filmmaking moment. It's unbelievable.
It's like, you'll watch it and you'll like leap out of your seat, like almost like wanting to applaud. It's that must have triumph of editing, acting, shot composition. It's great. But then the second half of this film, is like, what if Rashomon?
Yes.
But yes. A luncheon between bureaucrats trying to figure out, like, hey, why did this guy start doing shit? Like, why did he care? Like, that's what they're, like, the reason his wake is well attended is because at the start, this is very Parks and Rec. The very first shot of the film is this group of women from, like, kind of a bit of a recovering slum neighborhood, basically saying, like, hey, there's a sewage pit in our goddamn street. Like, our kids are getting sick. It smells awful. What can you do about this? And everyone's like, not my problem. That belongs to other departments, and nobody will fix it.
That's like a sequence. We get the sequence shots of, like, they go to this guy who's public services or whatever, and he's like, oh, that's not public services, that's public works. And then that goes from public works, like, oh, that's not public works, that's sewage.
It's like 5 minutes long. It's a really long sequence. Grows in humor as it goes along.
Yes, it's great. It's like, by the end of it, it's the deputy mayor, and he's like, it couldn't be me. Like, hey, what are you even doing?
You should go back to the complaints department where all exactly. this started. So this wake, though, they're trying to figure out, like, basically, you learn the guy fixed it. Like, before he died, he filled in the pit and built a park.
Yeah.
And everyone is like, it's become news. He's become a local hero to that community. And everyone's trying to figure out, like, why did he, like, how did he make this happen and why? Like, why did this guy who was a non-entity change everything about the way he went about his job lately? Did he know he was dying? Because he kept the secret, so everyone thinks his death is a shock to everyone. But they're starting to wonder, like, why did everything change for this guy? And it's interesting because it turns into, I don't know, it's a funny sequence because they're such, like, stereotypical bureaucrats. Uh-huh. But it also becomes an increasingly, like, it is comedic, but it becomes deeply moving. I thought, Austin, it seemed like you had some strong reactions to it while you were watching it.
I got some notes here. Ayo, fuck the deputy mayor. Ayo, fuck all these guys. I love watching these assholes being forced to confront raw empathy and connection. And then I have a quote here, which is, there's one point where this guy says, if I had to say what happened, well, it was a coincidence that the park got built. And it's just like, there is such a deep hate in my heart for people who are in a system, who sign up to be in part of a system that's supposed to make a lot of people's lives better, and then who effectively retreat from that responsibility and say, like, no, actually, I need to XYZ. Like, actually, I just need to collect my check and put my head down. And the last half of this movie is, or I guess, like, the final hour of this movie, it's a long movie, are a bunch of people kind of juking responsibility, trying to give credit where none is due to people where none is due, and to give no credit where it is due. And it is, for me, it's fascinating because I left the movie kind of torn last night. I've slept on it since, but unsure whether or not it was cynical about the role of government or if it was optimistic fundamentally, right? Because on one hand, this is a movie that opens with the statement, like, before that, he had some life in him. He even tried to do a little real work. But there's nothing left of that will or passion. They've been completely worn down by the minutiae of the bureaucratic machine and meaningless busyness it breeds. So it's, like, deeply skeptical of government bureaucracy as an institution, of having all of these departments that interface with each other, that allow a sort of passing the buck, that allow a sort of disengagement with the actual community. But there's also this sequence where one of the ways in which he kind of explores what is life is that he ends up becoming kind of creepily fond of a former coworker, this young woman. You know, he's in his 60s or 70s or something, yeah. Right? Maybe 50s or 60s. And she's in her 20s. And she's kind of given her letter of resignation. And in the day that she's done that, they've kind of kicked off a very strange friendship. And there's a moment in which he realizes that her stockings have holes in them. And he ends up buying her a new pair of stockings, like taking her shopping for expensive Western style stockings and socks. And she's like, why did you do this? Do the holes in my stockings make your feet cold? And I think the film's answer to that is like, yeah, of course they do. Yes. Like, we have a responsibility when we see someone with fucking holes in their socks to help get them on their feet and get new socks, right? Like, that is part of what the moral of the story certainly is. And I think, you know, having slept on it, I think it's just I have a much more naive thing. I don't think it's like a libertarian film. I don't think it's a film that's like, and then destroy government. It is a very naive and a very hopeful, like, no, just do better at your jobs. Like, take an ounce of the passion and dedication that Watanabe had into your role in life and fucking put the past in the past. Like, and go forward, which in a post-war period of Japan specifically is a very specific sort of message. At least that's what I'm reading into it, you know?
Patrick, did you, so it sounds like you ended up watching this. What did you,
I watched like the first 30 minutes or so, and like did some reading on it. Like I was fascinated about how the film was marketed in the U.S.
Oh, how was it?
Which is to say, it wasn't.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So there's in the way they did, it was actually like a complete, they weren't, I guess, clear how to market it. So there's a scene in the film where he's trying to figure out, you know, what's the secret to life. And he goes to a strip club.
Right.
And the American poster, and you should go look it up. Because like, this is a very like thoughtful film about like life. Love, like the pursuit of happiness, like what is happiness, how do you define that for yourself, and you know what you do among others. And the poster is like from the acclaimed director, like must see, and it's just an outline of a stripper, and it says and then it has the title of the film, which I forget what they doomed, I think is what they called it in the US.
Opposite Ikuru means to live. So it's like,
wow.
Literally the opposite.
Wow.
And so the movie, like, it didn't do particularly well, it was just, like, a very curious, cynical, shitty way to market a film that is, like,
yeah,
the opposite of, like, the themes. It was bizarre. But I made me curious to go back and see how, like, Kurosawa's movies just, like, more generally were marketed to Western audiences. Because although he is held up in very high regard, like, I don't know how much of the average moviegoer like understands how much of an influence like his work has actually had. Like, you know, like Star Wars doesn't exist like without Kurosawa. Like a lot of Spielberg stuff doesn't exist without Kurosawa. His legacy is something that I think is like often forgotten in modern cinema, even though like so much of it is defined by like a lot of the work that he did.
Well, and certainly movies like this. Like the movies that everyone uses reference points for Kurosawa are like the samurai films.
Yep. Right, Yojimbo and Seven Samurai and Rashomon,
yeah,
and Ron.
And like, yeah. Ron is a late career one.
I love Ron, don't get me wrong. Yeah.
But like a lot of his body work is these sort of modern dramas and such.
There's a lot of film noir in Kurosawa's oeuvre. Like Stray Dog is a fantastic crime drama that people should watch. And especially my favorite Kurosawa film is High and Low, which, if you are interested in post-war Japan, the image of nightlife in Japan, the class stratification in post-war Japan, High and Low, which is in Japan, it's Tengoku to Jigoku, which is literally heaven and hell, is fantastic. It's an adaptation of King's Ransom, which is like an Ed McBain procedural cop book, like American. It's an adaptation.
I love it, McBain.
You should absolutely watch High and, like, Rob, High and Low is your fucking movie, because it is about an executive, like a wealthy executive who's like, I think he makes like pants, or like, it's a clothing executive, has his son kidnapped. I think it's his son. And it is,
A friend of mine just told me about this movie. Okay, right. It's good. Like a comic, yes, caper almost.
Yeah,
it's, right.
Well, totally. Like, well, like, it's like darkly comic. There's lots of comedy in it, in that, in the bureaucracy of the policing, but there is also just like a real heart to the center of the film, because you get kind of closer to the world in which the kidnapper moves in than simply staying in the perspective of the Kingo, who is the king in King's Ransom, right? Is the executive, and it's definitely worth giving that a watch. It's beautiful, like a lot of Kurosawa's work is, and it there is something about this era of film which is just like people in a room talking is fun to watch, and it does that really well.
So two things. One, as it happened, like I ended up watching this movie basically a week or so after I was definitively cleared of having anything stomach cancer shaped going on with me. Like, literally, I turned to my partner in the middle of that movie, and I was like...
That would have been a bad twist halfway through this podcast.
Yeah, like, I turned to my partner, like, halfway through the movie, and I was like, well, this would have been a shitty thing to watch, like, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Because, like, as they're giving him the whole, like... There's this great joke at the start of this movie. This guy's like, look, they're not going to tell you if you're dying of stomach cancer. Here's what they're going to say. And he's describing, like, you know, just watch what you eat. Don't irritate your ulcer. But just don't worry about it too much. And I'm like, oh, they've told me that lately. Like, so, like, it was definitely a... weird timing watching this. But the other thing is that this movie, it's interesting. Like, the thing I'm still mulling over about this movie, and I don't think the movie, like you said, Austin, is it, you know, what's the movie's ultimate message? Is it cynical about government? Is it hopeful? I think it's similar about, like, how we spend our lives. Like, the movie ends on both a hopeful and a downbeat note.
Oh, it's brutal.
Like, on the one hand, the example this guy sets at the end of his life kind of does inspire the people around him to be like, shit, like, we are wasting our opportunities to help each other. We are wasting our opportunities to, like, you know, have our spirit move forth in the world and, like, you know, be in the world. But the movie also ends with this sort of acknowledgement that those moments of realization don't last. They didn't, like, this guy knew he was dying for 3 months. That was his gift, was that he knew, like, oh, my life is finite, and these are the last, you know, months I have. And I think I couldn't figure out what the movie intends to say here, and I think maybe it's open, but this is what I'm still mulling over. Is the movie's position that fundamentally it's tragic that none of us have any idea, you know, about the preciousness of our own lives, our health, all that stuff that we all take it for granted? Or is the movie more compassionate and understanding about it, that, look, it is also in the human condition, is also the human nature to take this for granted, to you know, waste time, yeah, and dwell not be minutia, acutely aware, yeah, of your mortality.
Yeah, like the writings I read, you know, like the essays I read about the movie and like the first 30 or 40 minutes I read or watched of it, it seemed more observational and critical, less that it came away with like a specific message,
right,
about, like, I don't think there's a call to action by the movie. It's more just like reading on Kurosawa and a lot of the films he was making of that era and the motivation behind making this film. Like, the original genesis of the idea of the film was that he wanted to make a movie about just someone learning that they're going to die and then what happens after you find that out. And it seems like a lot of his work, or some of his work, was like deeply critical of like the institutional structures of like Japanese society. And this just feels like him like turning the lens to bureaucracy in a way that, you know, there are ways that like a show like Parks and Rec does it, that is both like a commentary on bureaucracy, but like this does it like in a much like more sober, like measured way that like feels actually more in line with like even our own interactions with bureaucracy. I mean, like the moment early in the film when the group of women get so fed up with going around and they just fucking lose their mind. They just snap. Like, they just start screaming at the person who's in front of them, who is just one person in a very long line of people kicking the can. And that person may be kicking the can in like a genuine way where they are trying to tell them, like, but you just don't know.
Yeah.
I think we've all been in positions of like interacting with bureaucratic structures where you do get that runaround, and you get to that person where you finally just sort of like you just lose it. Like, that person doesn't necessarily deserve it, but just because of the way the structure that they're put into, like, you have no one else to unload on except for this person. And that moment in particular, but like, I felt you could feel the rage of those women, because I think we've all been in situations where we just like don't know what else to do except just sort of scream at the structure that's in front of us.
Totally. I'll say that, like, the one thing on this that I think there's one moment where the film does kind of answer your question there, Rob, of like, is this about going out and doing something, or is this about... There's this moment towards the end where the bureaucrats at the wake are just making excuses for themselves effectively. Like, well, we couldn't do this because of blah, or oh, this only happened because there was the group of gangsters who wanted to put a red light district in, and the park is better than the red light, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's all sorts of stuff like that, right? There's all sorts of just, like, excuse making and such. And at one point, they finally drill down. They're like, oh, he had cancer, and he knew he had cancer. Ah, I see. He knew he had cancer. That's why he did it. Well, you know, of course, if we had cancer, we would. If I woke up tomorrow and I had cancer, I would also spend the next 6 months doggedly pursuing my dreams. Of course, of course. And there's this one dude there, the guy who's kind of been the most sober, downer, like, truthful person there. And he's just like, we could all die today. Like, any of us. We all have cancer, right? Like, it's just... some of us are going to die in 30 years, and some of us are going to get hit by a bus tomorrow. We're all dying. From there, that is the moment where, like, it descends into a sort of shouting, talking match. Like, people are just yelling at each other. Like, they're overcome first by silence, and then by determination, and then by confusion. And I think that there is something there that is, like, Kurosawa is bringing to mind the confusion and the both the energy and also the kind of debilitating effect that recognizing one's mortality has in general. And does, I think it is an open-ended question. It's like, well, what are you going to fucking do with it? Any of us could die today. What are you doing with your life ahead of that? Which is a kind of a well-made point in media and culture, right? Like, live every day of your life to your fullest, etc. But I think it's particularly well-made here.
And also that, like, rhetoric and action are different things, right? Yes. Like, it seems like the arc of this film is, like, people learning, like, saying they've learned a lesson and they're going to do something about it. Like, I think this is notable for our own, like, political moment, right? Like, it's the difference between going on Twitter and saying, like, fuck Trump, and it's, like, and going out and, like, advocating for a local political candidate and knocking on doors, like, or doing some other form of actual actionable impact. And, like, I think the movie in some ways is cynical that most people aren't going to do anything with their lives. They may tell you that they're going to do something or they're going to make a change, but that by and large, most people are going to rest on their laurels and rhetorically will find some way to justify whatever they did, because actually in life, it is super easy to find. Like, life presents all sorts of reasons to not do something. Yep.
There is an implicit and partially explicit argument here that I almost wish that they had come out and said, just like in Serial, like a little more clearly, which is...
Yeah, Kurosawa.
Yeah, you're the Sarah Koenig of his day. There is, in the excuse making portion of the wake, where they're like, oh, but this only happened because X, because Y, because Z. Partially, that's all right. Like you said, Patrick, sometimes people have a reason to pass the buck. There is a regulation in place. There is an order to things that you have to not step on toes, or you've been told don't do this without proper authorization or without this, you know, go ahead or whatever. We work at a major corporation. We know what that is like. I know well what it is like.
There are walls around you that you can't always explain or justify.
You've made lawyers stop us from doing X. But sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes it's like, well, I've already made three requests of this person, and making the fourth one would seem like da-da-da. Like, it is hard to work inside of organizations. But one of the things that's underlying all of it is, like, yes, it helped that X. Yes, you know, this person did sign off. But at the center of it, there's this divide between actions that contributed to it happening and actions that were necessary for it to even get to those contributions to begin with. The sort of person who the character of Watanabe is someone who pushes it forward, puts it in front of people and demands that something happen. And as important are the women from the neighborhood who go to office after office after office well before he did, and did the same routine and then did it again once they had him on board. And it's like, those are the people to be, right? Even if you're not the bureaucrat, you can be the neighborhood who forces the government to pay attention, right? And this is why, like, you know, when people go to town halls and when people demand things in public from their representatives and say, hey, what the why are you cool with there being, you know, kids in cages? Like, I'm fairly or firmly of the mind that is doing your duty as a citizen. So if there is an example to take from Ikaru, that is the one that I would like to.
So what I hope you're going to do with your precious time is hang tight and listen to this ad.
God damn it.
You know what makes life worth living? Delicious low-calorie lemonade, baby.
It's especially funny for the people who get that programmatic ad.
A lot of you won't.
A lot of you won't. Who knows? It turns out advertising is like bureaucracy.
Hey, why do we keep getting these ads? Well, we can't control that. Sorry.
I can't. Listen, I can send an email.
Oh, no.
We didn't knock on enough doors.
I didn't.
That's what it was.
Which is true to some degree, right? Like, you fight the fights that you can fight in your hours at work. Like, I'm sure that if I was like, no, we're getting off of programmatic ads. I don't care what content goes on the website for the next 6 months. My one goal is we're getting rid of programmatic ads. I could probably make it happen or lose my job. But I wouldn't get anything else done. I hope you don't want to see an end of the year spread. I hope you don't want reviews for any games ever. Prioritize. Anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting this ad.
Here's a good ad.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I mean, I hope that was a good ad.
Who could say? I hope the volume levels were in line with ours. Impossible to
check.
Impossible.
Because fingers crossed.
By a computer.
Nobody knows.
I really hope it wasn't like a recruiting ad for some sort of like European nativist party. Anyway.
Please let us
which
know.
Which is a thing that has happened.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Yep.
Speaking of scary things and existential dread, Danielle, you got back from a family trip to Orlando where you partook in a spooky family tradition.
Ooh.
Yes, it was terrifying. Actually, it's very funny to tie this into other things and other hilarious, weird happenings in life. I went to Halloween Horror Nights, which I will explain in depth in 2 seconds.
I'm so jealous!
It's really good. But last year, when I was at Halloween Horror Nights, I had just learned that my father had a brain tumor. And so we were sort of like going through these haunted houses and things, thinking like, well, I sure hope we get to do this again next year, because, yeah, that was, like, literally what we were thinking. So this year, I went to Halloween Horror Nights, and it wasn't scary for that reason.
Oh, cool.
Which was very good. There was a happy ending to that one as well. So, Universal Studios, like many theme parks, like many amusement parks, does a Halloween season event. It goes from mid-September through the very beginning of November, and it's called Halloween Horror Nights. They have it at Hollywood and Orlando. I've been to both. More often than not, I go to the Orlando version of it. And what they do is they actually convert a bunch of buildings. I think there were like 12 this time, something along those lines. Into really, truly elaborate, very, very high production values haunted houses where you walk through and there are people in costumes, there are set pieces, there's bits of lighting, there's bits of staging, there's all this stuff. Very basically like a very high-end haunted house. So it's cheesy still, but very, 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 very slickly produced. And there's also things called scare zones, and those are outdoor areas where there are a bunch of scare actors in costume. Also some set pieces, also some bits of sort of interesting and cool lighting. Those are a little bit more freeform because you can walk through sort of at any, you know, there's no set path through those. Those are just areas of the park where there's scare actors and set pieces and people are going to kind of try to jump out at you and make you scream, but it's a little bit more freeform. So that's the like general structure of the event. You go from like 6 p.m. It's open till like 2 a.m. You go to as many houses as you want to. You go to as many scare zones as you want to. Some of the rides are also still open. It's really fun and I highly recommend it to fans of anything goofy, first and foremost, and also anything horror.
Did I see they're doing a Stranger Things one now, too? Was that open?
Yes,
did
you
see
it? The only house I didn't get to.
It's probably got the longest line.
But it's got a lot
like
of fairy
a
4 lines.
4-hour wait.
Jesus.
Did you start doing this, Danielle? How does this become a family tradition? I mean, I'm jealous because what I want to know is how do I turn this into my family tradition?
Absolutely. Well, you know, they do have, like, babysitters, so, like, you could totally go.
Wait, really?
In the hotel, you could totally get a babysitter while you're there, go with your wife and enjoy the haunted houses,
Gears
and then bring her
Gears
during
turning.
The day, you know, for the the, you know, child appropriate stuff, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, this is a plan you could do, perhaps, someday in the future. But yeah, it's a family tradition. We've been doing it for a few years now. We don't do it every single year, but maybe we're starting to. It's just sort of, it's kind of how my parents get me to go to Orlando at this point, because they love theme parks so very much, and I've gone to them kind of my whole life, and I find them fun in some ways, but also exhausting on a sort of corporate level at other times, and also, you know, they really do cater pretty insanely hardcore to, you know, middle-class white people with money, and sometimes that gets really exhausting. So the Halloween stuff, it's a little bit easier to ignore because I have all kinds of things, you know, sort of vying for my attention, in that, you know, it's Michael Myers actually trying to stab me and things like that. So it keeps my mind off of that other stuff.
Finally.
Danielle, when you said it was, when you said the word, it's becoming a family tradition, I'm watching a video. I'm watching 2017 Halloween Horror Nights 27 at Universal Studios Florida from iTheme Park on YouTube. And literally at a minute 03, which is where I was when you said the phrase, a family tradition, there was like a road work sign that said, an American tradition. And I was like, oh, weird. And then it changed and it said, United We Purge. Like, oh, okay, right. American
tradition. There was a purge house this year. There was a purge house. I went to the purge house.
I just saw the purge.
I went to every house but the Stranger Things house. Yeah, I know.
Wow, it's a coincidence that I just watched The Purge, too.
Maybe listeners and fans should maybe watch the first Purge movie for
something. Although there's so many people dying. What do we think of The Purge?
Good. Well, there's a lot of jokes like that. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of the houses that I found really cool. And I wanted to talk a little bit about... So there's this really awesome dynamic that I enjoy so much about this event every year. And I've been to four or five of them, I think, at this point. So I'm starting to get like a sense of kind of what goes on here. There are original content houses, which are, they made something up. There was a really cool house this year called Slaughterhouse Cinema, with an S instead of a C, which was the entire point of it, the whole sort of idea of it, was it is a bunch of grindhouse movies at like a shitty drive-in movie theater. And so these were all vignettes. It would start, each room would have like a movie poster for this fake movie. There was one called Amazon Cannibals from Planet Hell. There was one called Devil Dogs. There was one called Shitty's Kids with S-C-H-I-T-T-I-E.
Excuse me?
And that was like a murder at a Chuck E. Cheese, basically. Okay.
No, but I need to know. Whose kids were they?
Shitty's Kids.
I keep hearing Shitty's Kids.
Shitty's Kids.
I think that's what it was.
S-H-I-T-T-Y?
Exactly. Shitty. S-C-H-I-T-T-Y.
Okay.
Just really, really awesome. Like little, each room was just its own vignette of like a fake grindhouse movie. So much fun. Slasher movies, terrible sci-fi movie like Amazon Cannibals from Planet Hell, which of course I remember that one very well, which started out as like you're walking through a crashed spaceship, then you were in a cave, and there were the Amazon cannibals and like bathing, you know, like 6 foot tall women in bathing suits and like sort of banshee masks, you know, kind of like killing men. And then there were bodies everywhere. Really cool stuff, right? So those are the original content houses. There was another one called Scary Tales, which is sort of a fairy tale interpretation that had just incredible elaborate staging. You started in walking through, you kind of got some voiceover of like the plot, which was, you know, of course, a wicked witch has cast a spell on all your favorite fairy tales and now they're evil and they're going to kill you. And you walk through that, and then there's this beautiful, elaborate stage. It actually looks like a castle, really, really tall, and there's a witch, you know, scare actor, and she actually sort of flies over you. They had, like, a whole wire set up. So really elaborate, really cool stuff. So there are these original content houses, and then there are these interpretations of very popular horror properties. Stranger Things was one of them. Halloween 4 was one of them. Trick or Treat was one of them. That was a movie from, I want to say, like, 2016? A fairly recent horror movie. And one of my favorites was Poltergeist. Mm. There was a really amazing Poltergeist house.
I love Poltergeist. All-time great.
It was so, so good. And I don't want to, like, spoil the specific visuals. Because, what? You know.
No, pro.
Just in case.
No, nothing. Danielle, keep going. Go ahead. Patrick and I are getting beef later. Danielle, do you think Poltergeist is that good?
It has honestly been so long since I saw it that I don't feel comfortable giving an answer.
How was the house, though?
The house was awesome.
Danielle, as a fan of immersive Sims, do things like this really speak to you on a different level? This is me trying to avoid the Rob Patrick beef.
Yes, they do.
Can you talk about that a little bit, maybe? Because, like,
yes,
we explore a lot of spaces in video games, but, you know, this is not the, this is for real. You're in a space. Patrick, I just need you to hold it together for another, like, 45 minutes.
Okay. Hey, you should go to the house, Patrick. It's really good. It's really cool. You see a lot of cool visuals from the movie. Okay. One of the aspects of this, of course, that I love the most is exactly what you're getting at, which is that this is, so much of this is basically game design.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of splits the difference between game design and, of course, interactive theater and movies, especially where it's, taking off of a popular property,
sure,
or a popular movie or something, where it's like, oh, some of those specific visuals will be incorporated. And I think the creativity that goes into making these things is, like, unbelievably cool and really interesting, in the same way a lot of game design aspects are unbelievably cool and really interesting. They actually do 3D models of all the houses before they build them, before they actually build the sets or build the props or, you know, create the masks and the costumes and things like that. And there was actually a lot of puppetry in this year's show, which was really, really cool. There isn't always a lot of that, but there were a few, like, amazing examples of puppetry in the sort of, like, the monster design.
Not like animatronic,
what they were doing,
but like,
like actual puppets that a human being was manipulating, which I think is way cooler. They don't use a ton of those in this. They don't use a ton of audio animatronics. It's mostly actors in makeup and costume. So,
do you get a lot of time to, like, are these ones like a, like, I've been in a bunch of haunted houses, but it's sort of a sprint. You know, you're just like going from thing to thing. There's people behind you. You know, you're just going to whatever the next jump scare is. Do you get, because I know part of your, you know, the appeal for you with immersive sims, part of the appeal for, it sounds like, for these is like a chance to, like, take in the stuff that's around you. So, like, how, what's the pace of, like, these,
yeah,
like, these setups? How much time do you get a chance to, like, actually enjoy and appreciate the thing that's around you?
That's the part that is a little frustrating. They are trying to get you through relatively quickly. I always try to kind of slow it down a little bit, let people go in front of me, because I've been to so many of these that I kind of know these are on a loop. There's like a soundtrack going on, basically, and scare actors are, I know I keep using this term, it's the term that they use, and it's good and cute. I know it's like a marketing term, but they are sort of set to a specific timing, so I'm always like trying to hang back a little bit so I get the full effect and I'm not just behind somebody who's already sort of screaming and, you know, spoiling a little bit of the fun. My mom has like a little bit of a mobility issue, so she walks really slowly. So a lot of times I'm just sort of like holding her hand or like kind of have my arm around her and we're sort of walking through together very slowly. Occasionally, you know, the folks that work there are like trying to kind of get you to keep going. And I'm always like, it's fine. We're good. Like, we're still moving. It's cool. You kind of learn those little tricks a little bit. Some of them are longer than others, but it usually is like a solid 5 to 10 minutes going through a lot of these, especially if you're not, you know, really trying to rush your way through, if you are trying to savor things a little bit. And I do
right.
typically go a couple of days. Like, I went 3 days in a row to this event. So I saw several of these houses 2 times. Sometimes I go 3 times if I really love something. And you do see a little bit more of the detail each time, especially that Slaughterhouse Cinema house that I mentioned. I ended up going through a second time and taking like a picture of each one of the posters so I would remember, you know, what this goofy fucking fake movie was, you know, for the next time through, which was pretty fun.
Did these houses hold up to, because that was something I was curious about, like, talking of the parallel to game design, like, to me, a thing like this is always is sort of a bit like a ride, right? Where, like, you're on rails, and most people are only going to go through it once, right? They're only going to, like, see whatever is the main thing they want you to look at. And it is cool how amusement parks, like, direct your attention and control your eye line. I mean, I've only been to Disneyland. I went for the first time, like, in 2016, and that's kind of, like, the urtext of amusement parks in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But yes. I am kind of curious, like, did these reward repeated experiences? Like, as like after you'd seen the big scare they were trying to pull off, the big effect, were there details that, like, paid off for you and, like, enriched the experience the way games cool. sometimes do?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, I'll give an example. There was one house called Patient Zero, which was sort of a, starts as, like, oh, a medical emergency has occurred, and of course it's a zombie apocalypse. And there is actually a plot element through all of these, which is really awesome and does very much reward sort of going through once or twice, or sorry, two or even 3 times if you can kind of manage that, because you will pick up not only more details, but you also pick up more of, like, the plot that it's actually trying to get you to go through. So this Patient Zero house starts out with in like a medical tent. And I was with my sister and we were kind of joking like, oh, Celeste, it's your job, because she works at a medical nonprofit that provides relief in conflict areas. So it's like medical tent and it's like, oh, no, there's nobody in here. You see like a body, you see like a few details, and that's a little bit of stage setting. And they make you kind of go through two by two, and there's like a fog effect that's like, oh, this is the quarantine zone. And then you're kind of moving through the space, and you go into a subway and you realize it's the Paris subway, and there's a lot of lighting effects, and you start to see there's a use of mirrors, there's a use of actors, there's a use of all sorts of things. Now, the first time through, they use a lot of darkness in this particular house. Like, there are moments of pure black darkness, and, you know, there's a tiny, tiny bit of light on, like, the floor that's just like, you gotta just walk this way kind of thing, but there's a lot of darkness. So the first time through, I missed a lot of the details of like, oh, this is Paris. Okay, this makes sense. Like, there's actually a subway map that is the Parisian subway map that is like flashed on and off and flashed on and off. And it's like, oh, that adds a little bit of context here. Details like that you definitely see on the second and third time. And they are such richly detailed houses with so many elements of just the props used, the set design, the lighting. It's really, really, really incredible to kind of go through a second time and be like, oh, I missed that. Oh, I missed that. I missed that. I missed that. And I missed this. And this all kind of added to it for me.
I think the other thing I was kind of wondering about is that, so like, you spent most of your time talking about original, like scare environments, haunted houses and stuff like that. And like, I am curious for you how, like, what was more interesting? What was more powerful for you? Was it sort of what it, like, was it the houses trying to channel familiar films and like their tone and texture, or did you get more out of the novelty of like the stuff that was off-brand is the wrong word, but like original, that was new?
Yeah, I tend to enjoy the new ones. Well, I enjoy them for different reasons. The interpretations are so much fun because you're looking at how they're interpreting something that you already know, right? The Halloween 4 house was a great example because it was like the plot of the movie. You're moving through all these spaces that kind of go through
Halloween
the sort of general.
4?
Yeah.
Is that not a good one?
You're going through closets.
It's just a weird, like,
this is one of those.
The movies have a formula.
Do they always do Halloween 4? Other years, do they do different Halloweens?
No, but I have been in a Halloween house before. There was a Halloween, I think 2016, there was another Halloween house, maybe 2012. They definitely always do like 4 or 5 interpretations of properties in the Universal catalog, usually
okay.
tied to, okay, there's a new, like, this is obviously Stranger Things, right? Is like, yeah. That's
tied just, to it's just struck me as like, yeah. If that's true, that makes sense, because then it gives them like a different layout to work with,
yes.
And a different like structure to the story. Otherwise, it's just like, why Halloween 4?
Yep.
Like, is that, like, just pluck it out of a hat? Like,
in the catalog.
Well, it's Final Destination
yeah, exactly.
12 this time. Sorry, though.
There it is. There it is. I remember there was a Thing House in 2012. It was one of my favorites.
Oh, that sounds
great.
Oh, my God.
It was incredible.
Wait,
they
what?
But it was tied to, like, the new Thing. Because there was a new...
But was it...
There was a Thing.
Oh, that movie
But it was
a
John Carpenter's The Thing
House? A not great Thing movie. Yes.
Oh,
John Carpenter's
shit.
The Thing. It was incredible. It was the first... It was actually the very first Halloween Horror Nights house
Were
I've
there,
ever
like,
been
freak
in
your
life.
Shit out animatronics for that one?
Oh, yes.
It better have been.
Like, puppet
things?
Yeah. Like, running, you know, jumping up out of bodies. Man. Oh, my God, it was amazing. But, yeah, like, I really enjoy going to the, you know, their interpretations to see what they thought was important. And, like, that's fun. That's fun in its own way of seeing, like, oh, okay, this is how they decided to stage this or how they decided to kind of put this in. But the original content ones are really, really fun because they can just go hog wild. They can really just go nuts. They can really just kind of have fun with any concept. There was one that was called Seeds of Extinction, which was basically felt like The Last of Us, only with alien plant life instead of just, you know, clickers. But a lot of the scare actors looked exactly like clickers. They were like mushroom people or plant people, and had a whole plot about, like, oh, there was a meteorite that fell, and on day one, half of life was extinct on Earth, and then you go through, and it all looks very overgrown and lush and terrifying and gross. It was awesome. So, yeah, they can have a lot of fun with those sort of, like, oh, we just made this up. And I can only imagine what the pitch meetings are like for this kind of thing, right? Like, I've always wanted to do – they have a behind-the-scenes tour that actually – you know, goes into a couple of the houses and says, like, oh, we were thinking of this, and this is how we came up with this staging or this effect or this costume. And I've always wanted to be like, please, I want to know everything. How did you come up with all of this? It's so cool. So, yeah.
All right. Well, That sounds like a pretty great reason to go to Orlando, Florida.
Perhaps
the first one I've heard in my life.
That's where you can find this one?
One of the very best and only.
I can't find this one on my podcast app.
I mean, you look, you can probably like find someone willing to scare you. I mean, yeah, like that, true. You can probably just go to Craigslist. But
Donald Trump is president. Are you scared?
Always.
Speaking of like terrifying fates.
Back to Ikaru. Serial podcast season 3, the American justice system.
No, we're actually going to be talking about something that's potentially worse than all of those. And Patrick, this may sound rich coming from me.
Yes.
But get a load of this Cleveland Browns memoir you shared with us this week.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a piece called Hopelessly Devoted by Mark Sessler over at NFL.com. He's a lifelong Cleveland Browns fan. It's this long memoir essay about his devoted fandom to a franchise that has had nothing but nightmarish heartbreak and loss and just terrible play for his entire life. And it's just sort of like mixed in with like the ups and downs of his own life and just sort of explaining like why he's never given up along the way or justifying or trying to justify why he's never given up along the way. It's a really interesting piece about fandom, and it got me to start reflecting on just the irrationality of like sports fandom. Like, it's just such a, it doesn't make any
sense
yeah. At all. Like, it has nothing to do with the beauty of the game, right? Like, it's not like, oh, an appreciation for the form and skill of playing whatever sport. Like, in this case, it's the Cleveland Browns in football. You could apply that to any sorts of a fandom that you have, particular team. Like, you are just putting your faith and your interests and your hopes and dreams into a group of players that you have a specific rooting interest in them being successful, as opposed to just appreciating the form and success. And like, it made me think back on my own history with the Bears, who I have. They are my home team. You know, I grew up in the Chicagoland area, and then I have my own personal history with the team and the sport of right. football, because my father started out as a salesperson for Riddell Sports. You are familiar, even if you aren't familiar with Riddell, because yeah. they are the logo on the back of like predominantly a lot of the athletics equipment that was at your local high school. It was for a long time. They've closed the logo, but it used to be a big red Riddell logo on the back of all the NFL helmets. And so
I had a Riddell helmet.
Yeah. And so my dad worked his way up through the chain at Riddell. And towards the end, before he passed a number of years back, he was VP something something. He basically shadow ran Riddell Sports. He always turned down an opportunity to become the president of the company, because presidents of the company get ousted when the company has like a bad cycle that may be completely outside of their control, but that's just the way corporations churn. So he always stayed one or two steps below the rung, where he was essentially shadow running the company, but didn't actually get hit with like getting ousted because investors or whatever were upset the particular cycle.
And that was an era when getting fired as an executive might actually be a bad thing, as opposed to a way to get richer.
Yeah, there were
these people getting ousted were not getting golden parachutes. I mean, they're probably going to be an executive, you know, at Reebok or something like that. But my dad loved that company, and so growing up, I had no affinity for sports in particular. My parents had me playing basketball and baseball, not football, because my dad didn't think it was safe, despite the fact that it was like funding a lot of the stuff that our family did. Sure. And
damning verdict from like the like executive of the helmet manufacturer, like not my sweet baby.
Mm-hmm. As a result, like, my dad had like a close because he was a salesperson, a regional salesperson, before he like worked up his way on the sort of executive level, knew the Chicago Bears, the McCaskey family, who owns the Chicago Bears, like really, really well. I mean, one of the McCaskeys like came to my dad's like funeral. Like, that's how close, like, they revered my dad in some ways. And so when I was young, I didn't take an interest in sports and thus didn't have a fandom for the Chicago Bears, despite them being, quote unquote, my team or my family's team, because I did the thing that every shitty kid does, which is like reject the things that their parents are interested in and want you to be interested in, because that's what spiteful little shits do. And I look forward to that arc of having a child. And I look back on that where, like, so for example, one time, and I resented it at the time, I didn't enjoy doing this. Every time I tell this story, they don't let you do this anymore, but I was able to, when they kick the field goals after you score a touchdown, like, there are people that, like, pull up the ropes to get the net up. Like, I was that kid for a Chicago Bears game and, like, pouted the entire time. Like, didn't want to be there, didn't want to do it. I was on the sidelines of games. I hung out in the locker room, like, in, like, the 90s and, like, would get smuggled into the locker room because my dad didn't want to get actual access, like, verified access. And so they would just put me on the laundry truck because he knew the guy that did all the equipment stuff, because that's who he was dealing with, was the equipment manager.
Did you meet Jim Miller?
I don't know. Like, I couldn't tell you. Like, I made no notes of that era because, again, I pouted most of the time that I was there and being forced to go.
It was like you didn't want to go to church, except that church was the Chicago Bears.
Yes, like the Chicago Bears locker room and free access to like any game I ever wanted to go to. And they weren't a good, particularly good team at the time. But
they weren't the Browns,
like,
though.
They weren't the Browns. And so then it was later in life when I met my wife, who was like a hardcore Chicago Bears fan. And then we started dating prior to my dad passing. And then when she found out like the sort of access we could get to things, was horrified and upset. And then I still didn't really care about football in any meaningful way. But then when we moved in together, and then on Sundays she would go to, I'd be like, I'm going to play a video game. Like, I'm not watching this fucking football game with you. And she'd go around the corner to the local bar and come back, you know, three quarters drunk. And I'm like, what happened? She's like, they won. And then she'd pass out for like 2 hours and then we'd go get dinner. And I was like, I'm tired of like, my wife just like going to the bar without me like every Sunday. Not because I don't trust her, but I was just like, I should go take an interest in this thing that she's spending all day Sunday doing. And then as a result, became like very invested, became like very devoted for whatever that means, and have like, since then, like not only am I a fan of the Bears, but like deeply invested in a lot of narratives and the football as a sport. And so a lot of this essay like really spoke to me in terms of, again, like in terms of fandom. I can only speak to like the last 10 years or so, but in terms of like having a personal narrative with a team that is intertwined in your life, like I can deeply identify with that, because the Chicago Bears, even when I wasn't a fan, like I was part of that culture and like part of that team due to the regional factors and due to like personal factors. And I know on this podcast, we've talked about like our own sort of fandoms. Like I know Danielle, you have alluded to, like, I guess you root for the Patriots.
I
wanted to do was like, so that what I wanted to, so at, all that out of the way, like that was my takeaway from that essay.
Which again,
I was curious
that
to like
essay
ask
is
all of you.
Devoted for 32 years by Mark Sessler, over on NFL.com, which is about spending 40 years really, really being heartbroken. Yeah.
So I was curious. I wanted to kind of just go around the table as we sort of close out this podcast. Like, we've talked about our fans, you know, Rob and I are Chicago Bears. Austin, you are the Philadelphia Eagles. And Danielle, you sound like you have, explain to me you and the New England Patriots.
All right. When you grow up in New England, there's one city for six states. Okay. Like, that's it. There's one city. Rob, you know this.
Hartford.
Pittsfield.
Massachusetts,
thank
baby.
You, Austin.
That's what it is.
Boom.
Providence, Rhode Island. All right. So New England, and it is a baseball region. It is a football region. Basketball, hockey, super important. I don't want to like say they're not super important. Hockey, probably more than a lot of other places in America. Very, very important. Basketball, still very, very important. However, football and baseball are
America
in New England. Yeah, right. So you grow up, and it's religion. It is just like Catholicism. It's just everywhere you go. The church on the corner has the Patriots gear, the church on the other corner all has the Celtics gear, like everybody, you grow up, you have a little baseball hat, it's a Boston sports team. It is just religion where I grew up. So whether you are agnostic or atheist or not practicing that religion, it's still in the like fabric and the culture of all the people you're related to and have to spend holidays with and things like that. So every Thanksgiving, I'm definitely going to at least know how the Patriots did.
How's Tommy doing?
I didn't
seek
it out. Yeah. Oh, God. That's the thing that makes it rough is like, okay, there's no team that's like all the way great. Yeah, there's no such thing as not being complicit. Like, the NFL is terrible, right? The NFL is a bad thing. They do bad things. It's a bad corporation. However, you can still love a team. You can still care about a team. You can still care about how your local team is doing or whatever you have a fandom for, right? Tom Brady sucks. I will never
Hell
not
yeah.
say that Tom Brady does not suck because he's terrible and bad and he likes Trump and I don't get it. However, I can't. It's hard. It's really hard. I can't like denounce the Patriots because it says like it feels sacrilegious to say like die Patriots. You know
there's,
what I'm saying?
Not asking
like, it's like
die.
There's that
I just want them to lose.
There's that Faulkner quote I think a lot about where, like, you know, where in the heart of every Southern boy, it's always noon on July 3rd at Gettysburg and the brigades are lined up.
Oh.
I think, it, like, in New England, it is always the final 2 minutes of a conference playoff game and Brady's under center, right? Like, to a degree, like, even if you hate this, like, even if you're cynical about this fucking team and this and what Patriots fandom is, it's hard not to be like, oh, Patriots are down 7, down 4, you know.
That means
minute 50
up
15, left to play.
Honestly, yeah.
Great. Yeah, it's like, okay.
It's like you have to care on some level. Sometimes it's just easier to be like, you know what, I like the Bruins, okay? I like the Bruins. They're all right. Has anybody done anything horribly racist on the Bruins lately? Okay, good. If they haven't, great. Love those
Rob's
Bruins.
Disappeared.
Good
Rob
Bruins.
Has vanished.
Right.
Oh, no. Like, actually,
honestly,
on the
New
Bruins,
England sports fandom,
on the Bruins might be okay.
Yes.
Bruins okay. fandom.
Bruins
yeah,
fandom.
Boston.
That's the thing. Like, New England fans are awful. Like, I have no complications saying, like, New England sports fandom is horrible and has a lot of problems in it. It is just, like, one of those things. You are born into this religion, and you can choose another religion, but you're always going to kind of wonder how, you know, Father Mickey is
yep.
doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's...
It is a bit like Catholicism.
Can't help
like,
it.
Every single member of my family is lapsed Catholic at the same time. Like...
There's a lot of guilt
yeah.
involved.
Yeah.
Like, well, at the same time, like, if it ever came down to, like, okay, but what do you believe in? Chips are down. What is your faith? It'd be like, well, I need to get confirmed, don't I? Shit. Like, that's kind of how it goes.
That's what it is!
You know, I was... This essay hit me in a weird place, because, like, I resent my Bears fandom. Like, I kind of
sure.
went off on my
yeah.
dad the other week. He was talking about... He was like, boy, those Packers fans are assholes. They're so quick to turn on their team. They start booing if they have a bad half and all that. Like, you're booing Aaron Rodgers. You're booing the Packers. They're such a good team. They've given you so, like, they've been such a great franchise. And, like, one bad quarter and you guys all turned a bunch of ungrateful assholes. And I sort of had this moment where I was like, you know what? No, they're right. Fuck a bad team. Fuck them. Like, you know, maybe if Bears fandom wasn't this, like, self-defeating, like, kick dog, like, shitty, like, culture of, well, just support
yep.
the team. Like, it's almost good that they're bad, because then you know you're a real fan. You're not some bandwagoner. You're just cheering for a team that gets fucking
ass kicked. I've told myself that before.
Like,
when I watch bad games to the end, I've
yes.
told myself that, like, if I actually
care about, like, where this team's going, I'm going to look at the linebacker core, and I can appreciate, like, some good defensive line play, even in this loss.
I mean, this is like, what this dude in the story does, week after week after week. Yeah. Like, when I say it's 40 years, like, I just want to emphasize... So I know this intimately because my father is a Cleveland Browns fan, despite being from North Jersey. Like, I've seen
yep.
the struggle. I have seen the pain. And I know that lots of people who listen to us don't give a fuck about sports. And so just, like, imagine there is something you care deeply about in your life that might be imagine you're
Democratic
a
Democratic Party.
No. Because
Sonic the Hedgehog.
Sonic the Hedgehog.
Sonic.
You can influence
the thing.
Democratic
you can influence
Party,
the Democratic
right?
Party.
Like, you
that's
can
the important
vote.
Thing. Right, yeah. I think it's, like, Sonic the Hedgehog or... film, like, maybe you love, okay, let's say it's anime or horror film or something, a genre of entertainment or pop music or
Hey, oh, how about this? What about the Transformers movie?
Let's say you like Transformers.
There you go.
People love Transformers, and you show up to each of the new Michael Bay shit fests, knowing it's bad, but because your fandom is like, well, maybe this one's good. And you know what? Like, oh, like the design of Optimus, you pull out.
And then
I think that's actually a good analogy.
For 40 years. The Drive, which I want to explain, like, there were two consecutive years in 1986 and 1987 that are, like, touched on here, but are not necessarily given a lot of room to breathe in this guy's essay. In 1986, the Cleveland Browns were, like, poised to win the AFC Championship, go to the Super Bowl. They're poised to go to the Super Bowl. They're going to beat the Denver Broncos. They had them down to, they were, it was like a 20-13 lead or something like that. Kicked off the ball, and the Broncos had it at, like, the 2-yard line, like their own 2-yard line, which means they had to go 98 yards to score, and then he does it. And it's just, like, it's one of those Tom Brady-esque drives, right? It's that style of contemporary football drive where he does it, and the Cleveland Browns lose. And this is a good Cleveland Browns team. They could have gone on to win that Super Bowl. And then the next year, against the same team, they...
Well, and it's specifically, like, the destruction was so... It's been given a turn.
It's called,
like,
the drive. The next year was the fumble. And that was, they were down by, I want to say they were down by 6 points or something like that. They came into halftime down 21-3. Did this incredible comeback, had brought it back to 38-31 with like 5 or 6 minutes left, and then drove it down, were ready to score, we're going to go to the Super Bowl. And then they didn't. They fumbled, Beiner fumbles the ball. And the Broncos get it back, and it ends the drive, and the game ends, and they don't go to the Super Bowl. And that was in 1987. I was 3 years old. I was 2 years old. My father has been suffering since then. Every fall, this is the year. This is, I hear him every. It's draft season. Maybe we're going to get some good draft picks this year. It's trust the process, but the process has been so long that the team, the Cleveland Browns, disintegrated for 3 years and had to come back.
They moved
to Baltimore.
They went to
Baltimore. A Super Bowl, but the fans didn't come with them because it felt like a betrayal of the city. So they didn't even get that. So it's like, there's a material thing. It's like, what if a new Transformers movie came out every week in the fall? Every fall. And each one was, like, maybe you got like a couple of good moments, like Patrick said, a couple of good moments here or there, but you never get it. And so you care so deeply for the thing in a way that is irrational, in a way that is deeply human and deeply, like, emotional. And you're jumping on this horse. This is my horse. I care about this horse. And there's just a lot of time to lose. Compared to someone
the
like
horse died 10 years
the Patriots,
ago.
Right?
Yeah.
Who, like, if you were born in the year 2000, you didn't know a time when the Patriots weren't winning, weren't in the playoffs pretty consecutively.
Like, you're like a years, football baby boomer.
Right, 100%. You're just post-war Patriot, you know? it's raining me, you know? Like,
I am entitled to this.
Which is why last year when the Eagles won, when the Eagles slew their nemesis, when the Eagles got their first Super Bowl win, it was such an emotional moment for me, was because I'd done this investment over time in this team, and I hadn't followed very closely for a few years now, right? Like, I have such a mixed relationship with the NFL, but there was something about that early, I had the opposite experience of Patrick, right? Like, I was going to Eagles practices as a kid. I have, like, signed Randall Cunningham, Sports Illustrated. You know what I mean? Like, I was devoted. I watched every game that I could. I was, like, 100%, like, I'm going to become a football player. Like, and that fell away as I started in like, 2010, 2011. I stopped watching as many games when the CTE stuff started, like, becoming very clear to me, which is even before the last couple of years of the Kaepernick stuff, right? But even so, like, when that hit, it was unlike any other experience I had, because all of that investment felt like it paid off in a way that, again, completely irrational. I know you're listening to this and you're thinking, but, like, here's the Transformers is a really good one. I'm someone who's been, like, an on again, off again Transformers fan my whole life too. I like big robots. I like mechs more than robots, but I still like the Transformers. Did you see what those fucking robots look like in this new Transformers movie?
Oh, Bumblebee is the Baker Mayfield.
They look so good. They look
G1, baby.
It's all G1 Transformers. They all look like the original cartoon Transformers instead of looking like the weird, like, postmodern monstrosities of the Michael Bay films. And it, there was, I had that same feeling of, like, oh, wow, I'd forgotten I invested this part of myself in this thing, and it's paying off. That movie might be trash still. Who could say?
It's coming from the guy who did the Kubo okay. and like some of those other stuff.
Kubo was cool.
Yeah, like no, it should be good. It should be better. But again, that's it, right? Like
it,
it should be good. it could be better.
This is the
right?
season.
Well,
hey, sometimes you get Sonic Mania.
Sometimes you get Sonic Mania. You're right. Sonic is another great one. Yes.
Sonic has a thing called the Sonic Cycle.
True.
You get excited. You forget the bat. I mean, like. Yeah, Sonic is actually also a great one. Yeah, because you can just do Google search for the Sonic cycle. Like, there is an emotional cycle associated.
You know, like, in the rest of our... But then what is the Patriots in these other things, right? What is the thing? And why is it... Like, okay. In media, if there was a TV show as consistent and good as the Patriots have been in the last 20 years, I wouldn't hate...
Breaking Bad?
I guess.
Is it really 20 years?
Yeah.
Because I remember the Bledsoe years being...
Those are also good.
I also went to Patriots practices
those
years. Bledsoe years.
I don't know
years.
If it's a television show that's like...
it was before Tom Brady,
yeah.
okay? It was Bledsoe.
Yeah, Drew Bledsoe.
So Brady.
Right. I liked those
begins
Patriots.
Like, yeah. Is that like, what, 99? 98?
Brady is more like 2004.
No, he started in 2000.
No, he was before that.
Well, I mean, in terms of like him actually being...
The
you know,
who he
Mr.
is
team leader.
So
yeah,
they won Super Bowls in 2001, 2003, 2004, 2014, 2016, and they were in the playoffs in
all of those
86
years,
there's a break
one, right?
And then 94, 96, 97, 98, 2001, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2009, so skip 2008, 2010 through now. So
what happened in 2008? Was that where he tore his ACL?
Yeah. I'm just looking at a list. I think the Colts fucked him up.
But
anyway, my point is, if there was that in film or in... it does exist in film. There are directors. They're all-time great directors. I'm like, man, they just keep... Steven Spielberg might be the Tom Brady of film or something, right?
Yes.
People are like, I'm not sure. I don't know. But if there was that person, I might be discontent with some of like, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm actually saying is like, oh, this is why I don't like, you know, mainstream pop music or something, which I'm fine with. But is
Marvel
there something
might
like
be
that?
The Patriots a film.
Oh,
right?
Marvel
like
is currently
just a juggernaut that like next man up, next franchise up,
right.
Everything's replaceable.
Yeah,
like
it could
that's,
be that.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying, right? It's like this attitude, there is something about the level of investment I put into things like the Eagles that I did a long time ago, that I put into other things a long time ago, that I've given. So I used to have a shirt that said, John Mayer is the mayor of bad music, because I was an asshole. because I was at like 21.
It's not a bad shirt, though. Well, it is
it's a
bad a
good
shirt,
shirt,
but it's not a bad sentiment.
It's. I think it is. Fuck.
Now would be a good bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Put on your laptop.
And like, I was an asshole. Like, who cares? And so when I see John Mayer now, all that investment I put in that style of Austin Walker elite music lover, like, is just completely dispersed, right? Like, I don't care if I see someone who I don't have that hatred anymore in my heart, except for Tom Brady. And I think it's because a lot of it does come down to, like, well, why do the Cleveland Browns have to lose for since 1951? You know?
Also, villains are fun, right? Like, as much as I despise the Patriots, like, when this era is over, inevitably, like, it's gonna suck to not have someone... It's fun to
I'm
root
I'm gonna start rooting for the Patriots.
Like,
in 15 years, when they've lost for 8 years in a row, I'm like, oh, I'll give them a win.
I look forward to that.
Like, I mean, this is why, like, I was so praying for a King Lear-esque denouement to the Brady and Belichick era, where it's like... Like, Brady's going fucking behind Belichick's back to, like, trade Jimmy Garoppolo. And like, no, the kingdom should not fall to fall to the chosen. It should fall to me. Like, I am really hoping for that all to play out. But I'll be sad once it's over, right? I'll be like, damn. Like, now who am I going to hate? And, it can't just be the system. Like, it can't just be the NFL. You can't just hate... How do you hate a shield the way you hate Bill Belichick's arrogant fucking face?
There are some hateable people at the NFL ownership and executive, but they're not as personified, for sure.
Well, Just my advice, though, and this is maybe most relevant to Patrick, do not let your babies grow up to be Browns or Bears fans.
But you could be the Eagles of this year. This is the thing. You could be me.
I should go and find it. There was a podcast series from a couple of years back in which, so it's like, you know, for all of us, like our fandom is like regional, right? It's like where you grew up. Like it was what was around you. And there was a podcast. I can't remember. Maybe it was Grantland. Maybe it was somewhere else. But someone wanted to pick a team and they hadn't picked a team. And so they did a podcast series about picking a team and like going through a whole bringing on experts, people pitching different teams and doing a ranking and figuring out like, well, you can't pick like the best team. Like you have to pick like a team on the bubble that like, you know, it was a really fascinating series like because so much of our fandom is built in like is where we grew up. Like it was thrust upon us. It was not chosen. And so the idea of choosing a team to root for, and which actually happens here in this the essay, Hope Is Devoted. Like Mark Sessler did not, he chose the Cleveland Browns, even though his family rooted for what was it, the Bills or something like that. I can't remember, but like he chose the Browns because he got pitched on them.
His family are Giants fans. Yeah, the Giants.
And a friend in school pitched him on the Browns, and he just got on that bandwagon. And so I will tweet about it later after this podcast comes out. I will go and look up that series because it was just really interesting to watch someone do the mental exercise of picking a team because it's just so different than the way all sports fandom or most sports fandom
that
works.
I kind of want to do fun. That. It's fun. When I was
– I kind of want to
in
do
in my
that.
Teen years, when I was like 14, 15, post-Michael Jordan era. Like I grew up as a Chicago Bulls fan because I was like whatever. Yeah, exactly. I was a baby when Michael Jordan grew into his prime and like, that's what being good looks like, so I'm going to root for him. And then like after that, I was like, well, I don't want to become a 76ers fan because you know, South Jersey's Philly teams basically, North Jersey's New York teams. And I just like nothing about the Sixers really appealed. I liked Allen Iverson enough, but like I wasn't moved. And I ended up like doing the thing. I was like, I tried out a bunch of teams one year. I watched SportsCenter every day. I watched a bunch of NBA games at night. And eventually I came in as a fan. This is like, I think it supports a lot of how I like things in general, of the Sacramento Kings, who were in the one. I've never been to Sacramento. I didn't know where Sacramento was. Are you kidding me? I knew California. I didn't know. I thought it was like, I knew it was Northern California, but I didn't know what that meant really. I still probably thought it was south of San Francisco, which is wrong. I never looked it up on a map. What's that? Who cares? What I care about is that they're fun to watch. And this is like the era of like Jason Williams and Chris Webber and Divock and like that they moved the ball around in a really interesting, fun way. They like had plays that were like fun to watch develop. They like tapped into the part of my brain that liked to understand how games functioned. And it's why I'm still like, despite the fact that I know better, root for the Golden State Warriors, because it's like I like how they play the game. I like seeing them decimate a defense. And I know that makes me a bandwagon jumper. And I'm not out here buying jerseys. I'm not out here like cheering for them on Twitter even. Like I do my best to be a little more indifferent on Twitter. I think everyone should have a fun experience watching games. But that was the decision I made as a kid, and I'm that experience is really fun. It's definitely worth trying to figure out. Like this also happens with soccer. If you decide to like follow the British Premiership and be like, oh, I'm gonna like a soccer team. Like, all right, well, how the fuck do you decide which one to watch? It's tough.
So I think that will do it for this episode of Waypoints. Our thanks to Bowen for letting us use his track "Miss You" off the EP Pale Machine. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Danielle, where can people find you?
At fuck you, Tom Brady, but maybe I still care about Boston sports in some part of my heart. At Danielle.
It's a long at.
It's a long handle.
At Danielle Ari.
Gonna go right up against the character limit with that one. Patrick.
You find me at Patrick Klepek.
Awesome.
At Austin_Walker.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back very soon with – I'm not sure actually which – I don't want to give the game away here. I am not sure what you're going to be hearing next from us because we've got a few things in the wind. I'm not sure what the –
Friday show, I think.
I think.
Yeah, Friday show this week.
I think.
Yes.
Okay. I think. So. There could be a little, we'll see.
The one you're thinking of, I
think, is definitely next week.
We're punting for a we're going to record and then release it in a couple weeks.
I think that's a coward's choice, but we'll discuss. We'll discuss on the Discord afterward.
Yes.
All right, all right.
I have other reasons for holding it.
All right.
Short version, watch The Perch.
Watch The Perch.
Maybe give that a little watch.
Either way, we'll be back soon with another podcast. Hope you'll join us again. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.